Morning, everybody.
Morning.
So, as almost all of you know, this is practice period. And when I reach into that blue folder, I'm not bringing out poetry. I'm bringing out something that has to do with my practice, because in this practice period, that's, you know, I'm the head student. And the focus is really on my way seeking and on my practice. And today, what I want to try and do is talk about a couple of elements in my own current practice. And I want to start with a quote. I don't know whether we've ever used this before. It comes from the Pali Canon, and it's a exchange between the Buddha and his cousin, Ananda. Ananda is this wonderful, very warm-hearted figure, occasionally kind of doltish, but he had apparently a memory that allowed him to remember absolutely everything the Buddha ever said. So he was a wonderful resource. But in this particular little sutra, he comes kind of bouncing in and goes up to the Buddha, and it feels a little like he's kind of puppyish. And he says, "This is half of the holy practice, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." And the Buddha replies, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." Now, I don't know about you, but my image of the Buddha is sitting alone under a Bodhi tree. No companions. He has the earth which he touches to affirm his realization and his right to explore this path. In spite of the only companions he actually has are the ones he'd rather not have, which are, you know, all of the temptations, much like Christ in the wilderness. So it's very striking to me and rather surprising that he should say this. And I'm not going to try and explore it too much here, but I will say that as I've mentioned earlier in this practice period, companionship has been really essential to my own practice. And it didn't really start with Zen practice. It actually started when I grew up, as I mentioned in my Way Seeking Mind talk. I grew up in a kind of a small WASP ghetto outside of New York, which was a bedroom community for a lot of the men in the family who dashed off on the 757 or the 816 Lackawanna and went into New York. And so it was a fairly, during the day especially, it was a fairly empty little town, 3,000 people, lots of lawn space, lots of big houses, very quiet. I could walk the mile from school to home and not see anybody. It was rather unusual that way, and I often used to think, who's in, you know, I know the name of the people who live in that house, but I don't know how they live. And my own family, my own parents, partly because of the generation they came from, my father had graduated from business school in 1929, so he was focused on making a living, and he was focused on not only making a living, but making enough money so that he could kind of have a bomb-proof shelter no matter what happened. That's not exactly possible, but he did pretty well in figuring that one out. And my mother was his companion and kind of created the social situation around him. And neither of them were particularly psychologically minded. And of course, in that generation, kids were, you know, they kind of took care of themselves in some way. And so my experience of childhood was of more or less being left alone. And it had some wonderful advantages. But actually, I was hungry for more companionship than I had as a child, which is one reason I ended up, in fact, I think one of the major reasons I ended up looking for companionship of the kind I tried to describe last time in graduate school and in the work I did at San Francisco State, because I was giving up, and then of course at Zen Center too, I was giving up a certain kind of loner, maverick sense of myself, which I had developed as a kid, I think largely in response to a situation where that felt like the only option, you know. So that particular aspect of my life stayed with me. But of course, as I got older, and it worked fine or worked fairly well as a kid, and it had certain advantages even as an adult, but there were certain obvious disadvantages as well. And I certainly needed, when I got into Zen practice, I certainly needed all three of the triple gems. I needed guidance of a teacher. I needed the formal practice. And I needed sangha. I needed people I could talk to who were struggling in the same way I was to kind of understand the nature of this practice. And I had that certainly while I was at Zen Center. But I left Zen Center in the early 1980s. I got there in 1976. So I had about, I think, 7 years of being inside the community. I left right after the kind of struggles that Zen Center went through with its second abbot, Richard Baker, who left. And then I was part of the group trying to figure out what the next steps would be and to choose the next abbot. And after that was over, I was pretty burned out. And I think I also felt, maybe because of my childhood experience, and Ed and Steve Weintraub, who isn't here but who has been here, were two of the many friends I had who fled Zen Center. And as a result, I was kind of, I think, feeling the kind of isolation I hadn't felt in a very long time. And I didn't feel, rightly or wrongly, that I would have the opportunity to have the kind of conversation with the Sangha and with the teacher at Zen Center that I wanted. So I left. And it was about a 15-year break before I came back to Soto Zen practice. And how I got back was, in fact, through companionship, primarily Ed walked through the door. He'd been away at, you know, in the software business. And he actually had read a portion of the book, which we all struggle with, Shoes Outside the Door, in which I had told a story about him and Suzuki Roshi. And he said some version of, well, you know, you got that right. And he walked back into my life. I hadn't seen him really for quite a while. And he kind of brought with him, among other things, Steve, whom I hadn't seen, even though Steve was living in Green Gulch, and Lou Richmond. And primarily with Steve and Ed, we started hiking, meeting together. And that was the revivification, bringing back to life my own practice. So, you know, that's, I don't know how I would have gotten here otherwise, you know, without that kind of companionship. And aside from, you know, having two practitioners, several practitioners, but two in particular, Steve and Ed, as my companions, I of course had them in, as friends. And I wanted to, there's a book written by a woman named, she's a Jungian analyst, and her name is Barbara Sullivan. She lives in the Bay Area. And she wrote a book called The Mystery of Analytic Work. And near the beginning of it, and I don't know whether your various analysts know her or know the book, but near the beginning, she says, the human being cannot think or feel in isolation. That's a kind of wild statement. The self exists only in relationship, and the self varies from one relationship to another. There is no me in isolation. The quality of each relationship structures who it is possible for me to be. That one, you know, the quality of each relationship structures who it is possible for me to be. So the companionship that I could feel with Ed and Steve in particular, as my Dharma friends, was a companionship where I could be, you know, like that wonderful line from On the Waterfront, I could be somebody, you know. And I could be the kind of somebody who practiced in this Soto Zen tradition, which I had really wanted to do. So that's a dimension which is ongoing. My friendship with Ed and Steve is close enough so I can also be the various things I'm afraid I am or I don't want to be, and get some mirroring. So it's a comfortable sangha, mini sangha, which allows me to be who I am and also take modeling and inspiration from who they are in their practice as well. So that's the, I suppose, the first part of what I wanted to talk about, and I'm going to stop there for a minute and let's, you know, I want to get some feedback from you, hear what you have to say about that aspect of practice.
I thought that quote about there is no, without others there is no self, something to that effect. But if you turn it around and you think when you're meditating you're alone, and the goal is to be no self. To me, so is there, so, it almost has a positive aspect of the, you know what I mean? There's both things are good.
Yeah. Well, also, it's a very Buddhist statement in the sense that it says, whoever we are, it's in connection with other people. That whoever we are, it's in context. It isn't in isolation in the way that we tend to think of it.
I was struck when you said you left Zen Center for 15 years. When you were at Zen Center and you had that companionship and then you left so-called Turkey, so to speak.
Right.
Isn't that such a shock to the system? And where did you go for companionship?
Well, I mean, I had friends. I had a profession. I was teaching. I wasn't married, but Megan and I were living together. And actually, for all of that 15 years, I was living in the neighborhood of Zen Center. And we ended up in 1990 buying a house from Zen Center, half a Victorian house. So I was, so to speak, It was like it would be like living at Stinson Beach and never going for a swim.
So you were around. I mean, so you sort of had the transmission from a distance. I mean, you can see the
right,
ocean.
Right.
You can see the water on the ocean.
Zen pheromones.
Did you still sit?
I sat for a while. Kind of militantly deciding I was going to keep up my formal practice, but in the context of professional life, I kind of lost it. I lost the focus of my formal practice. I mean, I could say, well, you know, I tried to keep up certain relationship to the precepts, but really, I'd say formal practice didn't have the same meaning in my life as it had before. So the only other part of my practice I wanted to talk about has to do with vows. And I brought this book, Living by Vow, which is a wonderful book by a teacher who we've known at Zen Center and who is a Dogen specialist. And this is about a lot of the kind of baseline vowing that we do in practice, including the Bodhisattva vow. The vows I'm going to focus on are actually more generated by both my initial family life, my family of origin, and my current family, basically Megan and our daughter Annie. And when I was in this maybe lonely, but certainly fairly isolated childhood, I mean, there were some wonderful aspects of it I won't go into, and some of the companions I had were animals. I don't know whether anybody's ever gone to sleep on a cow, but in the summers I was at a farm in northern Michigan with my grandparents' farm, and I used to follow the farmer who did most of the hard work around, and he would milk cows, and there was one cow whom I got to know well enough so I could milk her. And one time when I was about 8 years old, I got over the top of her and I just, you know, draped myself over her. And she was breathing and I fell asleep. And talk about companionship energy, you know, it was pretty unique. But in that context, you know, I think I took a vow to some extent in my childhood. I was going to be this loner, and I was going to be this maverick, and I was going to go on my own way. And as I said, that served me in some senses growing up. But of course, when you get to be an adult and you actually want long-term relationships, it doesn't work so well. And I remember at some point, I didn't get married till I was 50 years old. And actually neither Megan nor I had gotten married before we married each other. And I remember I was in a therapist's office and I was talking about something totally different. And she said, you know, you're really phobic about getting married. So I think there was a way in which, you know, my kind of childhood had created, and I also remember a particular very lovely girlfriend I had in graduate school, and we were walking on the beach, and I found myself humming this song, and I didn't think about what it was, and it was "Don't Fence Me In." So, you know, I clearly had a certain disposition that I had to get over in order to get married, which I did. And I think that change in vows, and we actually had two ceremonies. One of them was at an Episcopal church in Ross, which was a kind of benign environment for our two Episcopalian families. And then we also got married at Zen Center in the city. Steve Weintraub and Linda Ruth Kutz actually did the ceremony in 1988, so we've been married a while. And that opened, and I think I could have kept my maverick status if it had just been marriage. But when Annie got added to the mix, and especially given Annie, who is, she's an Asperger's kid, which means she's kind of on the autistic spectrum. She has a certain number of kind of executive function issues. She doesn't read social cues so well. She's and at the same time, she's a very powerful kid. Our first nickname for her was Henrietta Kissinger, because she used to be able to, you know, completely run us around and argue us into doing almost anything for her. And Megan and I have been on a very intense parenting path, and we're still on it. Annie used to be in Utah, and we brought her back. She was there for 2 years at a school that focused on Asperger's girls and nonverbal learning issues. Now she's in Petaluma at another residential facility, which is, of course, local and happily paid for by the school district. So we will see more of her, and our parenting and work with her will continue. Mm-hmm. And that, too, has been, I think, the way in which I have, it's been the most forceful, energetic avenue that has required me to give up loner life and maverick life. So in that sense, I think even, you know, I could have hung out in Zen Center for several centuries probably without reaching the kind of intimacy that family life brought me that way. So that's basically what I wanted to say about current practice. I still have friends, and actually along with my Dharma friends, I was thinking about who else is in my life besides Annie and Megan and, you know, their our families, and my Dharma friends, and all of my friends are in some sense practitioners. They are not all Buddhists, but they all keep me, to a certain extent, awake and aware of certain aspects of practice. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
It sounds like you became your own companion. When you talk about companionship as another, but you developed your own.
Yes.
Your own best or worst companion, I guess, right?
I think that's very true. I'm not sure what you are thinking of, you know, you know, what touched that in you, but I
do think that's true. When you talk about being a maverick and, you know, you're obviously able to sustain what sounds like an interesting life and do a lot of things, but, you know, you have this maverick status, and so.
Yeah. I think now the way I think of it is that the companionship of others and sufficient time in this practice has made it possible for me to do something I couldn't do when I left Zen Center in the early 1980s, and that is be an independent practitioner. I mean, I'm still learning, obviously, but there's a way in which I feel like I can. There's this wonderful koan built into the center of practice, and it's expressed very well in the poem of the kind of Chinese founder of this tradition. And the first line of a poem he wrote is, "I go on alone." And then the second line is, "Everywhere I meet him," or it, and it can be either it or him, given the kind of ambiguities of Chinese. And that poem and that experience that triggered it followed a meeting with his own teacher, Jungian, who, and when he was going to leave Jungian, he said, "Please, teacher, when future people ask me what your teaching was, please tell me what I should say." And Yunyan didn't say anything, and they sat there together, the two of them. And then Yunyan said, "Just this is it." What is just this? In this context, you have the companionship of Dharma friends, Dharma brothers, and teacher and student, and you have the moment. So it remains this very wonderful combination, and later on when Dongshan wrote his poem, having seen his image in the stream, he talks about, "I go on alone, do not seek for others, from others," is, I guess, the first line of the poem. "I go on alone, everywhere I meet it slash him." And I will try to deal with the rest of the poem. But that is the kind of, it's a crux for how we practice. To be intimate and connected, and to have the independence to trust our own practice.
Could you speak of vows? I'm not quite clear tying it in. You had a vow when you were younger, but you changed that vow. So what is the power of vow that you're referring to?
Well, first, getting married is
a
vow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the context of a Buddhist marriage, you actually take both the three pure precepts and the 10 prohibitory precepts. So you, in the context of marriage, you are wrapped in practice. I recommend it if you. And of course, you know, I mean, as you, when you go through ordination, whether it's lay ordination, priest ordination, you take those same vows. And they do have the power, which I think, and this book does talk about this somewhat, along with all the vows we take in this context can supplant the vows that have that we have taken under the duress or in ignorance as we are growing up.
So I just want to make this one comment. So when you said your way-seeking mind talk, and today when you gave this talk, in a way, you needed to go back and rewrite your story or refine it or look back and that kid who ran around the woods and slept on cows and just little, you know, unto himself. You had to go back and look at it in a different way and more of a incorporated into who you were becoming.
Yes.
So are you constantly rewriting your story, going back and looking at it as you're traveling forward into deeper practice?
Yeah, I don't know that I think about the drafts passed through the present, but I'm certainly changing. And happily, most of the changing has been on the plus side, I think. I certainly wouldn't want to go back and be that kid that I was then. It'd be nice to have his energy and his body, but, you know, not the anxiety and confusion and isolation and lack of language. For me, part of growing up was I came from kind of dour Scots parents, Scots-English parents, and finding a language was crucial, which is why I think I ended up being drawn to literature. And they're, you know, one of the actually most compelling literary experiences I had as a kid, my grandfather read us Huck Finn. And not only going down the river, but the intimacy of this black slave, runaway slave, and this little white abused kid, you know. In Short Hills, nothing like that existed. Short Hills Country Day School didn't have any blacks in it. And Andover, where I went to prep school, had an occasional black, but I'd say it was pretty token. There certainly wasn't any place where I could step into a neighborhood that felt anything like a black neighborhood in any of the cities that we know. Edward?
This sort of brought up for me this question in my head, and that is memory an attachment?
Yeah.
All these things that we remember.
Yeah, they certainly can be, yeah.
But isn't that kind of what we're doing is non-attachment? So there's a conflict there. Because, you know, in the ordinary way, we're run by our past in some way. We're a product of that.
Yeah.
But it seems a paradox of practicing something that says no, you know, not no, but going towards non-attachment, and yet, you know, being the product of memory and stories and everything.
Yes, and genes and parents and all of that. But every moment we are not only changing, we have the option to let go of who we were the minute before or the nanosecond before. And in that sense, every nanosecond, every breath, we can remake ourselves. We can be open to the possibility of being whatever self the context allows us to be. And that's that quote from...
I'm talking about things that are in the attic.
Well, sure.
There.
Yeah. And that's why it takes a long time practicing to find the attic and dust off all that stuff and allow it to go to goodwill, so to speak.
That's a great image.
Just thinking about that, last evening I was sitting on my bed and I was suddenly thinking, oh my God, I'm at home in this house. And I got nervous because, you know, I've moved and part of me doesn't want to be at home in this house. But I was feeling at home in this house. So then I thought, well, what if I forget my old house? Oh, that would be terrible. So I sat there with my eyes shut and I walked myself through all the rooms and looked at all those things. And I was comforted thinking, well, I won't forget this. I have that place for so long. And I can be in this house, it's okay. But it was an interesting exercise of seeing whether I could, it's only been 2 years, it's not been, for heaven's sakes. But I don't want to be 85 and have forgotten that place. But anyway, it was a resistant exercise, and what you just said, brought it up about memory and our memories, and how do we hang on to them or whatever. But all of that, as I walked through the house, it was just tucked back in somewhere, you know, yeah. It was in the attic again, where it belongs.
I was like, are we talking about transformation? Taking something that was and then transforming it well, I'm an artist, so I know about this business. And is that the engine, the thing that makes it possible to live, to be alive? Because if we have those other things, we're dead. I mean, because they happened already. And this is our just holding on to a string, always. And the state you describe of nanoseconds and things like that, this is something to go towards, not. I don't know if anybody, I've never met anybody that in effect has no past and has no connection.
Absolutely not. You know, we go back to the fish, genetically, the worm, and we end up, as Hamlet says, with the worms. So. We have a long history, long future. Some of us may end up as fossil fuels millions of years from now. Other questions before we quit? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.